Welcome to Enduring Grief, Healing Practices and True Stories of Living After Loss, where we dive into real, honest conversations about the journey through grief and the support that makes it possible. I'm Sarah Peterson, an LCSW, and in this space, I bring my experience as someone who has walked this path, as well as my work with my nonprofit, Clear Morning. I'm often joined by two incredible guests, Dr. Marla Speyer and Dr. Dean Sharp, both incredible people and physicians who've spent their lives caring for people and have supported me personally on my journey through grief. In our first episode, I'll share my personal story and how I've come to this work, why it matters so deeply to me, and how it might resonate with you. Whether you're navigating your own loss or standing by someone who is, this space is for you. Join me as we uncover the stories, the struggles, and the hope that lead to healing. Let's walk through this journey together. Welcome back, everybody. We are so excited to have you here. And us three, as usual, are very excited to be together again. Even though we see each other frequently, I think we're always excited to be together, right?
Yes.
Yes. I'm not sure about the frequently, but...
Considering how many people want to see you, and maybe how many people want to see me...
That's correct.
Our paths align more than for most.
One might expect.
Right. So, hey, we're just going to take it.
It is a valued relationship.
Yes, it is.
Mutually beneficial.
And whenever we do these podcasts, I get to come over to their beautiful home and stare at the mountains out the window and usually get some kind of really good snack. So it's like a win-win-win-win.
Don't forget my peonies.
And the peonies. Yeah, the peonies are pretty special. Stop and smell the flowers, no doubt.
Well, and they're such a great symbol of they come, they're beautiful, and they go.
And they go. Another practice. And it's sad to see them go. I have a gorgeous bouquet of peonies right now on my counter, and I've been actually following the instructions from the farm that says keep the water cold every day and all the things, because I really don't want them to die. They're so gorgeous.
Might be attachment.
Yeah. You've always got something, don't you, Marlis?
Just saying. Well,
and if you're going to love them, you have to learn to love the end of them, too.
Oh, gosh. Oh, that's right. That's what we're talking about here today. Well, we're putting a little spin on it today. Today, we want to talk with you guys about what it means to be a compassionate listener or be compassionately listened to. Because I think a lot of our early episodes encourage people to hold space or not have a fix-it mentality, or what does it mean to just be with? And I often wonder, do we do a good enough job of explaining what that means? And sometimes maybe this little crew here at this table might assume more about people's skills than is fair, because we're in the biz. It's easy to forget that not everybody has heard this information at some point or another, but I think wildly so, most have not. So I want to see if you guys can back up a little bit, think about what it was like to hear those episodes where we were encouraging you to not fix it and just be with, and let us give you some tools to do that. One of them is compassionate listening. And as I was putting this outline together, I had to stop and pause and think about why does a griever need to learn about compassionate listening? So I want to toss that question out to both of you. Why does a griever need to know about compassionate listening? Because we've got grievers and supporters listening to this.
That's right. You said you were going to ask that question, and it's a perplexing question. And I think that probably the major place that the griever needs to be compassionately listening is to themselves, to be able to continually be open and to allow the feelings to be there, and to acknowledge that it hurts, and to acknowledge that things are always going to be different, and to be compassionate with themselves, to be kind to themselves in that process.
I think you're exactly right, because I don't think it's naturally upon the griever to provide compassionate listening to the people supporting them. And so, okay, let's hear what you have to say, Marlis. Dean, I love your answer. A plus. Ding, 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 ding.
Thank you.
No, that was brilliant, because as David White says, the answer to grief is grief. And so as both a griever and someone companioning a griever, the role is to be willing to allow space for that person to grieve. And in order to do that with empathy, it requires the person who is accompanying the griever to be willing to feel their own sadness.
And somehow keep it separate.
Oh,
that's
absolutely
the skill.
Absolutely.
Keep it separate.
No, no.
It's not about you together.
No, 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 no. But that's the way that one of the skills that Dean is going to talk about is that as you are listening, to just offer a potential emotion to indicate that you have heard what the griever has said, and or a lot of times when we're in difficult emotions, we're stuck. I mean, I may still remain emotionally retarded. It's hard for me to even know all the time what I'm feeling. And to have someone help me name what I'm feeling is so helpful.
It's good to know. And probably not everybody feels that way, but it's good to know.
Well, there are feelers and then there are
non-feelers. We'll just tell you not to listen to the non-feelers. Maybe they're just not worth it. Just kidding. We like the non-feelers. I'm just kidding. I gotta have humor, right?
Yeah. Okay, Sarah.
Radical acceptance,
Sarah,
of even the non-feelers.
You went through the meat grinder.
Was I a non-feeler?
I think you, as a bartender, were probably had some empathy, but I don't know that you were willing to feel all of your own feelings.
No.
Of grief and, yeah, we're not.
I think I was good with anger.
Yes. I wasn't going to go there, but
I knew that feeling. I think I knew the feeling of like success or like what it felt like to be doing good. Yeah, doing well. But you're right. I was out of touch. I did a lot of blaming. Interestingly.
I think it's important because you guys slid a little off track right there when Marla said to tell someone what they're feeling. And it's not so much that.
Not telling them or what they're feeling.
It's not so much that. It's more suggesting a feeling that is coming up for you as you're listening or accompanying the other. So I could be with someone who's telling me a story about grief, and there may be in my lexicon an empathic response to them that I feel that there's a touch of joy in what they're talking about because they're talking about memories which are causing them to be sad. But for me, I can also see that there's a piece of that which has to do with joy. And so I might say, it sounds like you're a little joyful too. And the griever might look at me like I'd lost my mind, which is fine. But they might also look at me and say, you know, I am recounting something that's joyful. And you know what? That's why it really hurts so bad right now. And now the person who's telling the story understands their story at a slightly deeper level. Not because I manipulated them, but because I simply reported what it was that I intuitively and empathetically noticed about what they were talking about.
Yeah.
So it's a way of contacting the other's experience through your own experience, and it shows the other that you're truly tracking and listening and mostly caring.
About the right stuff. Because it's really easy to care about things that don't matter out of an effort to show you're caring, but it doesn't matter.
Right.
I was out to dinner recently. A glass of wine got spilled. The staff was so sweet. They're quick, grab another glass of wine and brought it over the table. And they also included like it was their fault, which it was not a free dessert. And someone at the table had really been wanting this dessert the whole meal. So it was like, oh, great. Look at this free dessert, free thing. And when we shared, oh, look, we got this free dessert. Well, why? Well, because this glass of wine got, well, I never saw the glass of wine get spilled. And it was just like the most quintessential exposure of listening to the wrong damn thing. Like the thing to be heard was not that you missed the glass of wine being spilled. That is pretty much nothing to do with it, but that the staff here is amazing, that they took good care of us, that we have free cake.
Yeah.
And I know that that's not grief related or very deep, but those types of misses are just constantly happening. And I think if we're encouraging people to investigate their skill, they're going to have to back it up to those interactions before they can really trust the process of compassionate listening in heavier moments. What do you think?
Well, I can't help but associate that with the blessing that is said every week at Shabbat, Friday night in Judaism for the wine. And it's that the grapes, these beautiful, luscious, big grapes had to be crushed in order to become wine. And that it's like a regular reminder of the transformation that grief creates, that you have to transform from who you were to a wiser, richer person.
Yeah, that's true.
That would always be the hope. And I think if we can navigate these things the most conscious way possible, I think that's possible. I've also known people who have grieved and simply become bitter.
Yeah.
And somehow that doesn't seem like the most useful way to harvest what's potentially transformational. I think that there's also a place where I want to say about missing the boat completely, that lots of times when we're attempting to console or we're listening to someone in grief and the pain is so great that it's hard to even sit and listen to it for very long. In fact, the person who's receiving the story becomes overwhelmed in the amount of suffering that they're seeing, that oftentimes in an attempt to help, we say really stupid things in order to try and fix it quick or to make it all better or whatever. The story I'm always telling about that is, you know, the woman who has a miscarriage and it's a really hard time. And some well-meaning or somebody who's so overwhelmed they just can't tolerate it will say something really extraordinarily stupid like, well, at least you can get pregnant, or you can always have another one, kind of as if another one's going to replace the one that didn't happen.
Yeah.
That somehow that makes it all better. But it's such an attempt to, I mean, at one level, it's well-meaning. And I think you have to accept that. At another level, it's denial of the experience. And at an even deeper level, it's, I'm so uncomfortable that anything I can say that would make you feel better is going to make me feel better.
Yeah.
And it's where all that nonsense comes from. Aren't you over this yet? Goodness, it's been 2 weeks, you know? Can you just move on? You want to start dating or something now?
Right.
Can I introduce you to somebody? I mean, it's like, I'm tired of it. You get over it.
Absolutely. I mean, after Marley died, there was somebody. 2 weeks. Hey, it's been 2 weeks. Do you feel like you're making any progress?
Are you kidding?
I was like, no. No, I definitely don't feel like there's been any progress, unless progress is that my free fall is still occurring.
And that is awesome self-advocacy.
Yeah.
I mean, where you truly are saying, nah.
No. Mm-mm. Or when I had a miscarriage, somebody in the office said, well, that's what you get for telling people you were pregnant. And I said, I actually don't think that had anything to do with it, and walked away. And I was being flippant. Those were my less enlightened, more angry days, perhaps. And it was very true. Like, no, I think there was actually something wrong with the baby, and that's why this happened, not as a punishment for sharing my really exciting news. And I know that this person is a lovely, kind, warm person who didn't know what the hell to say to me.
Mm-hmm. The bottom line is we as a culture are not very good at being with discomfort. I mean, the message we get is watch Netflix, go shopping, eat food, do anything. But where in our culture do you hear it's not only okay to be sad, it's important to be sad, and it's important to be willing to grieve the loss of so many things as you go through your life, from the very little to the very big. And one of the gifts of being willing to authentically grieve is the presence then with the inevitable people that you're going to sit with who are grieving.
Yeah. Well, there's that quote you often share by Douglas Steer. Do you have it memorized, Dean? I do.
Oh, you should go for it because...
Well, I might not have it exactly.
It's close enough.
To listen another soul into a state of self-disclosure is quite possibly the greatest gift
that any human being ever gives to another.
I mean, that's the truth. And that's not interview them into sharing their story. That's not push them, guess for them, project onto them, corner them. That's simply to listen to them enough that they start to reveal their greatest challenges, vulnerabilities, joys, all the things. It really is quite a gift. And in sessions, sometimes I'll have people that come in and I'm one of these patients that sits down and straight 52 minutes with like a quick pause at the end that says, do you have any feedback? And then they'll almost always say, I'm so sorry. I did all this whole time. And I'm like, this is your time. And we are so thirsty for an unapologetic hour of downloading. I'm so relieved to have been here for you to do it. And even better, I got paid. I don't have to take this home with me. You are not impacting the way that I'm suffering today. I truly, truly think I can bear witness most of the time to these folks.
And I don't know, I feel like I have my battered heart is what makes me an elder. I mean, I bless all of you and bless me back that we continue to allow our heart to be wounded, because that is what creates the deeper connection between us all.
Yeah, and I don't think I could see 7 patients in a day if I let the wounds occur, and they're not asking me to join them in
no.
the wound, right? Okay, that's not what you're saying.
No, but I mean, come on. You have people who their story is still with you.
Of course.
Well,
there you
that's the willingness just to carry their story
yeah.
is, I think, of value.
Yeah.
And that the people who I have grieved, I carry them with me. And that, I think, is part of what it makes it okay to die, to know that you'll be carried.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Okay, but I'm going to bring us back to compassionate listening. We need okay. these listeners to walk out of this situation, the time they've given to this podcast, with some ideas. And so when I tell the story about the wine and focusing on the wrong thing, what kind of listening do we call that?
Distracted.
Or
distracted,
unending questions?
Or ending questions, yeah.
Tell us more about what it means to listen with unending questions. Because I think this happens a lot.
Yeah, it's that part of us, which is mind, running our mind, is so desperate that we know all the details of the story that what happens is we just ask unending questions. So somebody starts to tell a story about something or share something, and then you just want to know everything there is to know.
And I think in grief, that is so scary for the griever, because not everybody tells you that their person has died and then wants the follow-up question of how they died, when they died, how old were they when they died. And most of the time, I'd say none of those details are relevant to the moment.
Exactly.
Someday, yeah, maybe. I mean, I'll have grief clients who it takes me 3 or 4 sessions to kind of wait for them to volunteer how the person died. Because unless it is relevant to the part of the story, like, oh, I cared for my dad with dementia for 10 years, I am exhausted, there it's relevant. But to say, my brother died suddenly last week and I'm completely spinning out of control, I can't eat or sleep, at that point to ask how the brother died feels really stupid.
Not useful.
Right. And yet we think that's an important thing to do, to show we care, right? So what would we tell these supporters?
That's showing up with an agenda.
It is.
You know, it's showing up with, I got to know all the details, as opposed to allowing the person who's telling the story or coming forward with what's going on in their lives to drive the agenda themselves, and to simply follow and be curious and open and kind of in beginner's mind, and to be fully present in your mind, but not to ask all those questions, and in your heart and in your body.
So how would somebody know, like, is this the right question to ask or not? Because we're all conditioned to ask these really ridiculous questions.
Yeah, in general, I'd say if you're asking a question, you probably don't need to be asking one.
There you go.
If you really, it's conveying to the person that you're truly there and listening, and that's done with body position, that's done with attention, that's done with eye contact, that's done with an open body position. And occasionally you might come in and suggest an emotion. They're saying, I can't get anything done. I don't know where I'm going. I'm just finding myself spinning my wheels. I'm out of control. And you might just come in and say, you sound overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Where were you supposed to go?
Right. No, you sound overwhelmed, or you sound really sad, or it sounds like you're out of sorts, or
scared. Yeah.
Yeah. Or whatever. And people will stop and they'll say, yeah, I am overwhelmed. And suddenly they have a term for all those symptoms they were talking about. And it's not because you've manipulated anything or you're kind of magic. All you've done is contact your own empathy in the place of what you're hearing and fed it back.
Mm-hmm.
And they might say, no, I don't feel so overwhelmed. I just feel sad.
Yeah.
And then perfect. great.
We've got the actual real-time data.
Yeah.
And maybe a question driven by that exact experience is okay. I might say something like, have you been sad all day or did it just show up? Because that's two different types of sadness, but we're actually still talking about the thing,
right,
which is I'm sad. Right. Not, wait, did you get here today? Did you take 3rd Street or did you take the Parkway? Because that can be really upsetting. Or whatever dumb thing that is irrelevant to what we've just discovered. What are other ways that we don't listen to each other?
Oh, we interrupt one another all the time.
That's terrible.
Just notice sometime when you're out to dinner with a group of people, how often people are interrupted. And every time they are, if your eyes want to follow the conversation, because that's what you naturally do. If you spend a moment looking at the person who is interrupted, every time a small death occurs.
Yeah.
I mean, another way we don't listen well is with the intention to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
I know that when I listen to my wife, Marlis, here, when she comes home with some story about something that happened and she's either angry or bewildered or sad or whatever, if 5 sentences into it, I have a plan of action. You should.
Uh-huh.
And this is who you should talk to. And I can get you the phone numbers. And I get that look like, thank you very much. But
you know what you should do?
Yes. You know, you should go.
Well, I think the word should is a real good indicator that we could pause and reevaluate what's coming out of our mouth or in our internal dialogue. Because the word should is a lot of times connected to you're not doing it right. And I know better. Or you're not doing it right, so you should be ashamed. You're making a mistake on purpose if we're using the word should. And of course, sometimes we know we are making a mistake on purpose. Oh, I shouldn't eat this 3rd ice cream bar. Here I go. And a lot of the times we're just using it really loosely. And we're telling ourselves a story about, well, I should be over this. I should be able to go to work. Been kinder yesterday to the friend who said the terrible thing to me. There's all bunches of shame attached to each one of those shoulds. I call it the should slip. And same goes as a supporter. You should eat something. You should get out more. You should go back to work. You should take time off. It's just this I know better sort of statement. And so if you find yourself hearing or saying the word should, it's a great time to step back.
Right. Well, I think it's the difference between being in charge, like the parent, and journeying with.
Yeah.
You should eat something is way different than, how about we get something to eat?
Or I wish you would eat something.
Yeah.
Because at least I'm being honest about this being my situation, my discomfort. I wish you would eat something. I really do. Or could you eat something? Or how about we get some food? All of those eliminate the power differential. You agree, Marlis?
I agree.
You're a quiet little mouse today on this episode.
Well, this is Dean's brilliance. He's like
Dean's brilliance.
Yeah. No, I am.
Is Dean a perfect listener?
Hell no.
Nope.
No, he's like...
Where does he struggle the most?
Oh my God, he interrupts me all the time.
Tiny deaths, Dean.
Yeah, tiny deaths.
Tiny deaths.
I know.
No, you teach what it is you need to learn.
You know, the reality is that one can know an enormous amount of information and incorporating it in your day-to-day behavior is always an amazing kind of challenge.
It sure is.
And that's the part where I also want to just be clear that a part of listening to yourself is having compassion for the fact that you're not going to be perfect at it probably ever.
Ever.
No.
And can you be kind to yourself in the process of learning or coming back and correcting?
Yeah. Even if we're looking at the ice cream bar situation, instead of shouldn't have eaten that 3rd bar, I can say I didn't have to eat the 3rd bar or I wish I wouldn't have eaten the 3rd bar. Those statements alone are not driven by a shame story. They're driven by I have wisdom of my experience. Next time, maybe I'll think more clearly about that decision. Maybe not. And moving on with the day, right? What about other ways people don't listen? I feel like there's at least one more. My life chapter.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's a pretty common cold of the grief experience from supporters, too.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it in relationship specifically to grief, but for sure, that would be true, that you're in grief and talking to someone about your grieving and you stop to take a breath and they're off and running with, you know, the same thing happened to me back in 1965. Let me tell you about it. And there you are, off in my life story, chapter 43. And they are talking and talking and talking about something which is not what the griever needed now.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting when I am meeting someone new who's lost a loved one to suicide, I know that it's not helpful for them to know that I also have experienced the loss from suicide. And boy, I'll tell you, it shifts my intention and attention immediately to just their story that moment. And it's the challenge is because when I am with someone like that, my own story comes right up into my throat and is right there to process again. And yet I know that in this moment, it's not about me.
Yeah. I think that too is a skill because I do believe that there are times in which this connection of understanding, it can be so rich. And that would be the time to pause and say, what is this person really, really trying to say? I think I'm the only one who's ever been through this. And that might be, I'll hear that from bereaved parents. And that is kind of typically my cue to say something like, you're not the only one. There's a bunch of us in this club and it's terrible, and leave it at that and just kind of see what happens. I also think then there's a place as a supporter who's experienced a similar loss to say, and ask me anything. That's what I do. And let me tell you. Right. But like I open the door and say, you can ask me anything. If I don't want to answer it, I won't. But please ask me anything.
One of the things that really drove me as a physician or hospice or any time is that I really feel like any person who I get to have the honor to listen to their story and be with them, I'm going to learn something. So there's a place where I listen and or am present to another wondering, what is it that I'm going to get to learn here?
I love that because that's honestly one of the skills I use to remain focused for sometimes 7 straight hours of listening is using that inspiration to keep me fully attentive to their experience. I'm not tuning into much to what's happening to me. I don't want to miss what they're going to say. I'm constantly challenging myself to find what they're really trying to say. And if you find yourself doing that and make that a practice, there's very few, if ever, times where I'm like, oh God, where were we? Crap. I have no idea what you were just saying. Because I have been really consciously trying to understand what they were saying. I don't find myself just letting their story wash over me at all. I'm consciously saying to me in my head, don't screw this up. No, I'm saying, what experience am I going to be ready to connect to?
Well, how about what's the gift here for me in learning about the human experience? And it's love the other as yourself because they are. And their story is my story, and we all learn together that way.
Yeah, I do. When I teach the social work students, I tell them that that's the worst thing I think a therapist could do is have the client look up and say, where was I? And the therapist go, don't know, wasn't listening. So that I won't be that person. And I don't think I'm that person in my regular personal relationships either.
And you know, I'll make you a bet you have been at some time, and I forgive you.
Well, thank you.
And do you forgive you?
Never.
Yeah.
Yes, I do. I do. I am human.
Yeah.
I am human. And none of this is to say that any of us are ever going to do it perfectly, like you said. It's not about that. And if perfection was the only success in this practice, why do it? So,
well, I think it's really important if you say something stupid, which God knows I have spent a lifetime doing, to say, wow, that was really stupid. I'm so sorry.
I did that yesterday, actually. I called my daughter's school and said, and the gal who answers the phone, she also works the concerts a lot of the time. And I almost always see her there. And she's the happiest person. And she's looking like she's having so much fun. And when she answered, I said, you get to go to the concert. And she said, get to work at the concert. And it was a real misfire on my part. Like, that's right. She's not going to the concert. She's going to her second job after working all day at the school. It's work. And great for her. She gets to hear this great band. Anyway, I saw her at the concert and I said, I'm really sorry. That was super insensitive of me. And I realized that you weren't getting to go to the concert and that you were in fact working here. And then I told her what an amazing job she did. And she said, thank you.
Oh, good for you.
Thank you. She said, this is my favorite job. And no, I don't get to go to the concert. You know, it was nice.
Well done, Sarah.
I know. I was really... Yeah. And the friend who I was with was like, you're a better person than me. And I was like, well, then win-win.
It's someone said you're a better person than me, like it's a competition?
No, I think it was more in jest. But also, I think that we can hold up the mirror for each other. We can be teachers in these vulnerabilities and in these willingnesses to be with and sit and model that.
That's all it's about.
Yeah.
Is the learning.
So let's go back to the original question. Do we have anything to add? Why does a griever need to know about compassionate learning? What would we want the grievers to take away from this episode today?
Boundaries.
Okay.
I mean, who?
Self? Grief? The other?
Yes.
All?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Well, immediate grief, it's like a neurologic, it's like a whole body shutdown. I mean, I really think that if you can just take a breath, that is really the only expectation that anyone can have of you. I mean, and that would be my self-talk at that point, is simply that there's oxygen available for me. Can I remember to take a breath?
And compassionately listening to that means what?
Silence.
Okay.
Yeah.
And no, like, shoulds.
Oh my gosh, no. No, 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 no. I mean, at that particular point, there are no words that are going to mean that you just sitting with. Be the knees. Yeah.
For yourself, even.
Right. And allowing yourself. It's interesting, and maybe this isn't relevant, but I was meeting with the guy who arranges advanced care for my 95-year-old mother, who's in, she's in independent living, and she still walks 3 miles a day and swims. And I mean, she's in great shape, but her marbles are running around a little looser than they used to be. And in the opportunity to be with him and talking about more possible care, I began to grieve the loss of my mother. And I even teared up. And it made it clear to me that one of the greatest gifts that I can give myself as a griever is to take care of as many of the details in advance that I can, so that when she dies, I can just grieve. And so I think that the greatest gift and somebody with them is, you see, whatever details there are, take care of them.
Yeah. And to think about you compassionately listening to yourself in that moment, one, you were with the grief.
Right. I was so proud of myself.
I'm really proud of you too.
I know.
Because a transformation occurred, even if it was a business transformation around the details, et cetera. You know what I'm saying? Paperwork transformation.
No.
But there's more to it. Of course, we know there's many layers to even simple paperwork. And it reveals that even in that moment, there was a transformation.
Well, and this is the classic cultural example, in that I said to my mom, oh my gosh, I just am going to feel so overwhelmed and sad when you die. And her immediate response was, don't feel that way.
Classic.
And that would be the next way we don't listen, which
is
deny the other's experience.
Yeah, talk to us about that, Dean.
You just heard an example of that. It's any time that someone will come up and say something like, I'm sad or I'm angry. And the first response is, you shouldn't feel that way.
Uh-huh.
Or why would you feel like that? As if there was something illegitimate about how I'm feeling.
Right.
I mean, it's how I'm feeling. I mean, I don't need it. I don't need you to second guess or to deny it. So yeah, that's perfect. Good for your mother.
Good for your mother.
Oh, she has raised the level of this podcast.
I mean, even so much as I'll have a presentation and I'll say to almost anybody, oh gosh, I'm kind of nervous. Ah, you'll do great. You'll do great. I know I'll do. I'm not worried about doing great. I'm worried about having a booger in my nose, or I'm worried about looking fat on camera. I don't know, but I'm not worried about doing great. And that it just like misses the whole point. I'm worried about something very different. I'm worried about how it feels to have this grief thing be the subject of my life. Boy, I didn't want that. Or I'm worried about what it's going to mean to talk about Marley, or you know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
You'll do great. It's such a cheerleading, wonderful, loving thing to say, and yet it is totally dismissive.
Right.
So what could they say instead? I'm like, oh, I'm really nervous about it.
Oh, I'm hearing you're nervous. What are you nervous about?
There we go.
Yeah.
Find the experience.
Yeah.
Tell me more.
Tell me more. That's, I mean, really, just being curious rather than fixing.
Yeah.
Oh, we so desperately want to fix.
Yeah, no, I have it bad. I really have it bad. I'm just gonna.
We do always confess on here, so this is one for this episode.
This really, really good friend who is just going through. I mean, his life is completely coming unglued. I mean, huge grief. And the other day I started quoting Hildegard of Bingen, all things shall be well, all manner of things, Afterwards, I just felt like a bozo. I mean, talk about not listening. Mm. Don't quote platitudes to people. Mm-hmm. Of course, I did. So I'm going to be compassionate.
Yeah, because myself. The thing is, it's almost always driven by enormous love.
It is.
And we're learning.
But I'm going to go apologize.
Yeah.
And say, oh, that was really stupid.
You don't even have to say stupid. You can say, here's what I wish I would have done. And then provide it.
Okay, deal.
Here's what I wish I would have done. I wish I would have just sat there. So let me sit there.
Yep.
Okay, so we have a few more minutes. I love the idea of like rewriting the script for people so that they have these tangible things like we just did, right? Like, oh, tell me more is a really good one. What are some other things that people can say when they want so badly to fix it, or they want so badly to tell their own story, or they want so badly to interrupt? Tell me more. Thanks for telling me. I don't know what to say is also a good answer.
What else?
What else? I'm here for you. And another strategy I often talk about, especially with clients, but I think I've shared it with you guys, is, you know, if you're listening to somebody in the details, because sometimes storytelling can get really thick with meaningless details from the storyteller. Okay, that happens. Or, you know, they're trying to share about an experience and you have to hear about how it started actually 10 years ago at the campground in the mountains. And now we're talking about something completely seemingly unrelated. I look at them and I think, okay, I don't know why they always have to be in a field, but they have to be in a field and they have to be frantically waving their arms in my imagination. And they only get like 3 to 5 words. You know, when you're having those dreams and talking is so difficult and you feel like you've just got a mouthful of glue and you can't get it. Like, that's kind of how I picture these people desperately trying to tell me the one thing. Oftentimes it's, I'm so scared. I'm so sad. I'm lost. I miss this person. I feel unimportant. And the whole story could be about something just, I mean, I use driving all the time. The whole story could be about an experience on the parkway that was so frustrating. And they get to my office and they're so mad. And if I picture them in the field, it's not about being late. It's not about their air conditioning not working. It's about fear of safety. It's about fear of being insignificant. It's about fear of disappointment. Have I let you down, Sarah? And do you think that's a good tactic? Could you see that working?
To see the people in the field.
Yeah.
Waving their arm.
And you just give them 3 to 5 words, and it's like, what are they really saying to me?
So you pick the 3 to 5 mm-hmm. words, or they pick the 3 to 5 words, or you offer the 3 to 5 words?
I do a combination of those things, depending on the situation. Most of the time, I share with them the 3 to 5 words I've come up with for a check-in.
There you go. Bingo.
But sometimes, if they're not stopping talking, and this is my friend or this is my client, I can't interrupt them to say, well, if we're going to put you in a field, I need to know what those 3 to 5 words are. So I will try to then listen to the rest of what they're sharing with me through the lens idea that I've come up with. And then, like Dean's talked about, circling back in. Sounds like you're scared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's one of the...
drive on the parkway had you rattled.
Yeah.
You were really worried. It sounded like you were really worried about how I was going to take it, that you were late.
Yeah.
I'm okay. Anyway. Yep. That's my strategy.
Yeah. Well, and it's always one of the primary emotions.
Yeah. And I think as the griever, the storyteller, also a strategy to connect with your own experience, to be able to say, what are my 3 to 5 words? I am scared. I do miss them. You know, sometimes people go on and on and on and on and on about being lonely, 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 lonely. And I'll say, well, have people, who do you want to come over? Let's call them. Well, I don't want anybody over. Well, who do you want over? Well, the person who died. Oh, so you miss them. You're actually not lonely, so to speak. You miss your person. And I think that when we can work with the true context, context, people get somewhere. Final thoughts?
Yeah. It is a process of dying to who you were and living a new life, because it's a completely different life.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of emotions on the way by.
Yeah.
And they're healthy.
Yeah.
I mean, how wonderful, because the more you're willing to feel them and the more you're willing to name them and acknowledge them and allow them, that is where the healing comes. Because, I mean, the truth is, you're not really alone.
No.
And you really are loved and you really are held. And there is peace available, and there is joy and even the little things available when it's time.
Well, like being listened to, like being heard, or like hearing someone.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredible comfort, incredible peace. Dean, final words?
No. Nope.
Takeaways? You've nothing? Said it. We've said it all?
Said it all.
You know, you teach this a lot, this content. Did we miss anything?
I don't think so. I think it covered it very well.
All right. Well, we hope you guys will come back for our next episode. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Enduring Grief, Healing Practices, and True Stories of Living After Loss. We hope today's conversation brought you comfort, understanding, or simply the assurance that you're not alone in your grief. If you found this episode helpful, please share it with someone who might need to hear it and subscribe as a way to stay connected. We'll be back next week with more personal stories and practical guidance for navigating the complexities of loss. Until then, take care of yourself and remember, there's no right or wrong way to grieve. You have the freedom to mourn in the way that feels true to you.